Support for WPR comes from Stafford Rosenbaum, a Wisconsin-based law firm celebrating 145 years of commitment to practical legal solutions in areas such as family law and estate planning. StaffordLaw.com.
Support for WPR comes from Isthmus Partners, an asset management firm providing comprehensive financial planning and tailored investment solutions for long-term growth and capital preservation. More at IsthmusPartnersLLC.com.
It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in today for Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a state representative about her efforts to overturn the state's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage.
But first, in honor of Valentine's Day, we're talking about love with a true expert. Our next guest has gotten a panoramic view of love by editing the New York Times Modern Love column for the last 10 years.
He's boiled down all the wisdom he's gleaned from the column in a new book, and he's with us to share that wisdom now.
Our guest is Daniel Jones, author of Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers. He's a contributing editor at the New York Times, where he's edited the Modern Love column since it started in 2004. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, in the book, you talk about how you yourself you really closed yourself off to love for years on end, and how, as a result of that, or despite that, did you become the editor of the New York Times Modern Love column?
Yeah, it's a little weird, isn't it? I mean, the time when I was out of touch with my feelings, if I want to put it that way, was back when I was in college and my first several years out of college, where, like a lot of people, love scared me. Being vulnerable scared me. Being rejected scared me. And so I sort of kept my distance from all of that. And, it was many years later when I ran into the woman who would be my wife, and she got me talking about these things.
Well, and it does seem really interesting that there are points in our lives where we are feeling very afraid, very vulnerable, and we'll talk about being vulnerable and love in a little bit. But it seems like a lot of the time we're both really afraid of it, and we also, there are a few things we want more than to be loved and to have someone to love.
Exactly. I mean, the stakes couldn't be higher, which is, what causes both the desire and the fear. And you can't really, people... What I've noticed in almost more than anything, and something I explore in the book, is how desperately we try to sort of find shortcuts through the difficult parts of love. And we try to find a shortcut through vulnerability, and we exploit technology to do so and whatever other means, but there is no shortcut.
And you talked about having been closed off and that your now wife kind of found you despite your best efforts. Was that the start of you opening up and being willing to take those risks, was when she appeared?
Oh, I think it had, my evolution had started a few years before. I was interested in writing, and I went to graduate school for writing out in Arizona, in Tucson, Arizona. And that's a world where, everybody is trying to explore what they're feeling and how they can get it down. In this case, it was fiction and also nonfiction. But I'd say that the process began then, because you really can't be a writer and be afraid of going into all those sort of weighted and dark areas.
So as you were starting to go into those dark areas of love, did you have to develop something of a new vocabulary? Was it almost like learning a new language to talk about those topics that you had kind of held at arm's length?
I'd say it was a new language. It was also just having any language to be able to start those kinds of conversations. It just wasn't really a subject that I talked about at length before.
So you get many stories sent to you from a huge range of people. How do you logistically sift through all of those stories that you get from readers every day?
Well, it's a very orderly process. They come in every day at the rate of over a year, I guess about 5,000 a year.
Wow.
And I just, in a very democratic way, start with the ones that came in last and try to work my way forward and try to stay on top of it. But it's a tough task. It's you would think that an open submission column where people are sending in their stories, and some of them are writers and some of them are not, you'd think there'd be a lot of bad material you could dismiss quickly, but there isn't really. Mm-hmm. It's really a lot of well-written material.
Oh, and so how do you decide what gets published? Is it something that resonates with you? Is it something you think will resonate with your listeners? Is it kind of an iconic love situation, or is it a totally unique love situation? What's the criteria?
Well, you know, you said it all. It is all of those things. Usually, when you're in my position and you're reading so much material, you become so easily bored. So something that is fresh and keeps your attention stands out. And usually the choice is a fairly obvious one, but it can have to do with the particular voice or perspective. But the subject matter is important. I hope to cover sort of a kaleidoscope of human experience, and certain topics get covered, and you're not going to cover them again the next week or in the next month or in the next 3 months. So having a fresh perspective and that we really haven't covered ever or haven't covered within months is important. And also having something, it's called modern love. It's not just called love.
Mm-hmm.
So some aspect of the experience that's contemporary, that would happen now and wouldn't have happened 5, 10, 15 years ago.
Well, and thinking of it in that, through that lens of modern love, I mean, modern life is really dominated with opportunities for us to express ourselves, whether it's on our Facebook status, whether it's on a blog, whether it's talking to friends socially at work. What do you think it is that is still an attraction to people to actually send in their story to a column or a columnist like you?
It's kind of an individual thing, I think, but what I value about the column and what I think readers value about the column is that we learn through stories. You know, stories teach us how to live and always have and always will. And the love industry, if you're going to call it that, has been sort of taken over by people telling you what to do and advice from, you know, supposed experts. I think what's valuable about the column is that it teaches through example, not always of good behavior, but of what people have experienced and what they've struggled with. And people teach themselves by reading these sorts of stories.
I'm guessing that the vast majority of stories you read, you digest, and then, you know, you kind of send it on its way. But I'm wondering if there are some stories that just really stick with you that you're not able to shake, maybe in a very positive way or maybe in a negative way.
Oh, absolutely. Among the, you know, the best stories we've run have been, you know, devastating stories that were, I'm sure, very painful for the person to write about, whether it involved the loss of a spouse, or in one case this summer, I published a poet from Chicago named Courtney Queenie, who'd written a very difficult piece about getting beaten up in her apartment by her boyfriend, and fleeing the scene and calling the police, and then the process of the following months of trying to get a restraining order and bonding with other people in her situation in courtrooms who are also seeking restraining orders, and exposing that whole world. What a difficult piece to write, but it hit readers like an exploding bomb. You know, it was really a powerfully done piece.
We're talking with Daniel Jones, author of Love Illuminated and editor of the Modern Love column in the New York Times. He's with us to talk about love, especially modern love, on this Valentine's Day.
And we want to hear from you now. What do you think about the state of modern love today? How much has love changed in your lifetime, or has it at all? How did you meet the one, the person you're with now, or the one that got away? Do you have any questions, advice that our guest may have learned writing this column and taking these stories in. Call us, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can send an email, talk@WPR.org.
We're continuing our discussion now with Daniel Jones about his new book, Love Illuminated.
We're taking your calls now. What do you think about the state of love today? How has love changed? Are ideas of love changed over your lifetime, if at all? And do you want to share your story of how you met the one or the one that got away on this Valentine's Day? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org.
And in fact, Daniel Jones, let's start with a call. We have Ben in Green Bay on the line. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, just was wondering, you know, if Daniel had any thoughts about, you know, love sort of in the digital modern world. You know, we have these digital presences now that we're able to, you know, delete and edit our words and things we want to say. And, you know, if there's anything that we're missing in, you know, reality from compared to when we can just, you know, create our digital presences. And so if he has any thoughts about that.
Thanks for that call, Ben. Daniel?
That's one of the subjects that I hear so much about. And, you know, it's interesting because it's such an opportunity to meet people online, and it's so easy compared to how it used to be. And you can look up profiles of people. You can meet people through Twitter or through Facebook or through any number of social media platforms. But I think a lot of people, and what I've discovered and what I explore in the book, is it's so easy to get close emotionally to someone online. And we're fooled a little bit into thinking that this is, you know, a bond that will then easily extend into a physical relationship when we meet the person. But so often we race so far ahead with this deep emotional connection with someone online, and then you meet in person, and it doesn't even seem like the same person you are communicating with online because the emotional has raced so far out ahead of the physical connection.
Well, and you also talk in the book, Daniel, about the fact that because a lot of people are using, say, online dating services, you can narrow down the pool of people that you're looking at, and you might be narrowing down and eliminating a person that would be perfect for you or would be the person that you really connect with. But because you put certain limits on age or income or smoking or religion, you've basically lost that person before you even start.
Exactly. It makes us think that we ought to know in advance who we'd be compatible with, but we ought to know according to categories, not according to a specific person. And so often, and I've seen this again and again, we're surprised by who we fall in love with, and we're surprised by how opposites can attract, and we're surprised by a magnetism we can feel in person with someone who we would have ruled out on paper. So that although the world of online dating is a boon in terms of how it exposes us to, you know, just limitless numbers of people, it also, you know, with a lot of people makes us retreat into thinking we should only go out with people who are like us or who are, you know, a certain height or make a certain amount of money or our religion or have our same hobbies. And those are dangerous thoughts to think, you know, in terms of ruling people in or out.
It's really interesting, I think, because part of the attraction of doing something like online dating is that you feel like there's this limitless pool of possibility. Mm-hmm. But there's no way to actually explore that whole pool. So we do narrow it down. But then that means that we are limiting basically what we can imagine as a possible love connection. We're limiting it down to that smaller pool anyway.
Exactly. I say in the book, it's more for the schemer than the dreamer, because you're forced to scheme in a way about who you think you would love. You don't think so much with an open mind when you're trying to rule people out. The whole goal is to rule people out because you can't possibly date 100,000 people. So you really risk ruling out all kinds of people who might have been perfect for you, or you might have felt an incredible magnetism for if it hadn't been for the online, you know, process.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that really struck me in reading the book is that you talk about how the Peace Corps actually turns out to be this great relationship factory.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
And it's kind of, I mean, if you think about meeting a partner in the Peace Corps, it's about as polar opposite as you can get from that limitless pool of, say, on Match.com or OkCupid.
I hear that again and again, that, you know, imagine that you're alone on a desert island with four people. You know, you're probably going to fall in love with one of them. No matter who they are, you're probably going to fall in love with one of them if that's what you're limited to. And it's almost a relief for some people to have that huge amount of choice taken away. You stop forever thinking there's someone better out there. You stop that sort of endless distraction of being on one date and thinking already about what the next one's going to be and who the next person's going to be. And you start focusing on getting to know somebody. And you move from sort of the shallow evaluation of a person to the deeper evaluation of a person. And it has a higher success rate, I think, than the exposure to the 100,000 mm-hmm. strangers online.
So does that old-fashioned dating that you just said would probably happen on a desert island or maybe in the Peace Corps, is that still alive and well in our modern technological world?
Well, I think it's certainly still alive and well. I almost think it's the way that most people still continue to meet, whether it's in school or at a job or in a club or through friends. Those are still the main ways, but many, many people are, you know, looking for love in ways that involve algorithms and science and technology.
Let's go back to the phones, and David in Burlington is up next. Hi, David.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
Well, you know, I'm not a young man anymore, and my wife and I have been married for almost 40 years. And I still think like a young man, though. And but what I found about love is it's about commitment. It's my wife and I have a lot in common, and we appreciated that in the beginning. But it's more the where love has grown the most over the years is in what's given away and not in what's received. And just commitment to family and making it work no matter what, and keeping your promises and respect. That's what's important to me in love now.
Thanks for that call, David. And Daniel, is that a theme that you see in the submissions that you get?
Yes. The last chapter of my book, I asked the question, do you think love is more of a feeling or a choice? And, you know, most people will say that it's a little bit of both. When I posed that question to my wife, she said, without missing a beat, romantic love is a feeling and married love is a choice. I didn't know if I should be insulted by that or not. But it's true to a large extent. We feel love during a romantic phase of life, and we begin to choose love when the romance and the passion starts to fade. You choose who you want to be with and who you want to stay with. And as the caller said, you commit to that person. You know, not always are marriages meant to last forever, and people can be worse together and maybe should be apart. But there definitely is that sort of transition, I think, for most couples from the feeling to the choice.
So all of these stories that you've read over the years of people's love lives and the impact different events have had on them, it gives you and the readers a snapshot of that period in their life. Is it difficult for you not to know how things turn out in the long run just to have that little slice of life?
In the long run for the essays themselves?
Is it hard for you to read about their lives and maybe care about what happens to them but not get that resolution whether things turned out well, whether they turned out badly?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I feel like I sort of weighed in their lives just for a short amount of time. Although with a lot of these people, believe it or not, I've kept in touch with them and heard about their, you know, struggles to continue or how they've come out of something for the better. And it's been an interesting long-term process over the years to hear back from people and hear their subsequent stories.
Daniel, what's one piece of love advice that you would offer our listeners on this Valentine's Day?
You know, one thing that I've really noticed and that I explore in the book as well is this concept of a soulmate and how so many of us now, you know, love used to more be about practicality and then it became, I mean, marriage used to be about practicality and then it really became about romantic love. And this idea that we're supposed to be with a certain person out there, and I think 73% of Americans believe that, that there's someone out there that we're meant to be with. And I think the concept of soulmate works if someone over 5, 10, 15, 20 years becomes your soulmate and becomes someone who knows you deeply and you believe you're meant to be with them. But I think people going and looking for love with the idea that there's a perfect person out there for them, that proves to be a very high standard. And I think a lot of relationships unravel maybe prematurely because we expect that person to be perfect from the start.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Daniel.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
That was Daniel Jones, author of Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers. He's a contributing editor at the New York Times, where he's edited the Modern Love column since 2004. He joined us for a Valentine's Day look at love. It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it is Valentine's Day. And for this week's Food Friday, we're doing some Valentine's-themed baking.
First, though, two Wisconsin lawmakers announced yesterday evening that they are leading an effort to repeal the state's same-sex marriage ban. They are Senator Tim Carpenter and Representative Jocasta Zamarripa, both from Milwaukee.
In 2006, Wisconsin amended its constitution to specifically ban same-sex marriage with a vote in both the Assembly and the Senate and a referendum with 59% of Wisconsinites voting in favor of that ban.
But today, same-sex marriage is legal in 17 states, including Wisconsin's neighbors, Iowa, Minnesota, and Illinois. This morning, a federal judge in Virginia struck down Virginia's ban on same-sex marriage, and last week, the ACLU in Wisconsin filed the case challenging Wisconsin's ban.
Here to discuss her bill that would reverse Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage is State Representative Jocasta Zamarripa. Representative Zamarripa, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, looking back at 2006, when the same-sex marriage constitutional amendment was approved, what did you see as the attitude then surrounding that issue here in Wisconsin?
You know, I remember back in 06, I was actually an organizer for the Fair Wisconsin campaign, and we were working to defeat the ban on marriage equality. And in Milwaukee, I mean, we had a great response from many of the communities that we were canvassing. But at the end of the day, we know that 59% of Wisconsin voters supported the ban on marriage equality at that time.
Do you think things have changed since then?
Absolutely. I know things have changed since then, in terms of how Wisconsin voters feel about marriage equality. We know that just late last fall, Marquette put a poll out that indicated that Wisconsin voters, a majority of Wisconsin voters, support marriage equality for LGBT Wisconsinites.
You're introducing this legislation, but Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has said it probably won't get a hearing. How do you respond to that?
You know, I implore Speaker Voss to consider having a hearing at minimum on this bill. I think it's good for us to get a sense, not just my side of the aisle, but also his side of the aisle. I believe that we have, I certainly have seen the numbers of independent voters that overwhelmingly support marriage equality, and I believe we have a growing number of Republican voters that would also support marriage equality, and a hearing would help us come to that conclusion.
Your effort comes right after an ACLU filing trying to overturn the ban, the same-sex marriage constitutional amendment, in the courts. If you had to pick which avenue is more likely to end that ban, do you think it's the courts or the legislature?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, certainly in the courts, we just saw a victory in Kentucky in the courts, and I think that's great. But I really think I have always, as an elected official, strive for these legislative victories. And I think it would do the community, the public, a world of good to be able to bring it through the legislature and repeal it in that process, because we can bring the public in for a hearing to offer their insight and testimony and really make it a teaching moment, really, if you will.
Also, a federal judge struck down Virginia's same-sex marriage ban. Also, we've got one way or another surrounding states, Iowa, Minnesota, and Illinois, having legalized same-sex marriage. Why do you think Wisconsin is kind of a holdout in what seems like a trend?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, we know that the Republicans have a majority here in Wisconsin. They have the majority in the state Senate, in the state assembly, and as you know, in Governor Walker's office in the executive branch. That's the holdout at the end of the day. That's why it's so difficult to get this through the legislative process, and why probably the ACLU felt so strongly about bringing it through the judicial system.
Some people are talking about legalization of same-sex marriage as something that's inevitable here in the state, maybe around the country. What do you see as a timeline for when it might actually happen?
You know, it's going to happen when we start to pick up. I mean, truthfully, it's going to happen when we start to pick up Democratic seats, so we can flip the, at least one of the houses in the legislature. But also, as I said, I believe that Republican voters are starting to see that equality is the way to go for us. And so if the Republicans continue to have the majority, we got to keep on pushing them, keep on educating them. And perhaps in a decade, we'll see Republican Party start to shift on this issue. But it's slow going right now. That's why I'd rather move to pick up those Democratic seats, maybe pick up a Democrat in the governor's office.
The reality now is that it's a Republican legislature. It's late in the session, not apparently a lot of interest in bringing this, as we mentioned, to a hearing. Given all that, is it just symbolic on your part to introduce this legislation now?
You know, I I've heard folks say that it's so late in the session. We have Republican bills coming through the legislature at record pace through committee right now as we speak. Bills that are going to be on the floor this coming week. This could be a priority of the legislature. If they see marriage equality as important for Wisconsin, we could absolutely put this through the legislature this session. Nevertheless, whether or not it happens, I believe it's a victory, because right now you and I are speaking about marriage equality. Right now we are helping to shift public opinion towards equality, and in my opinion, that's a victory already.
So looking back over the last 8 years since the marriage ban was overturned, you mentioned polls showing attitudes changing. Why do you think those attitudes are changing over time?
I really think it's because, you know, I was just talking with the Milwaukee County Executive, Chris Abley, who wanted a kind of a briefing on how things were going on the rollout, which we had a press conference yesterday. And he always loves to point out the millennials, the young people, the young electorate that is emerging. And I believe absolutely, I saw it in 06 when we saw so many young people, especially on near college campuses coming out. They were determined to vote because they knew this referendum was on the ballot and they wanted to vote for marriage equality and against the ban. I believe we're seeing those millennials more and more. They're coming of age. They're a large part of the population. They want marriage equality for their LGBT counterparts.
Even if you manage to get this through this session, overturning or changing the Wisconsin Constitution is a long haul. It's got to go through two sessions of the legislature. Then it's got to get approved by the voters in a referendum. Do you think you can get and maintain that kind of momentum on an issue like this over effectively a two-year haul?
Yes, you're absolutely right. It's definitely a long process, but I know I see the excitement around an issue like this. I believe we can continue the momentum. I believe if we can get it to a referendum to the people of Wisconsin, I know that we will prevail and we will have marriage equality in this state.
Now, you mentioned that you would rather do this legislatively rather than in the courts. Supposing that you don't get the change in the legislature and the governor's office that you're hoping for, you don't get the referendum, I guess, would you take a court overturning the gay marriage constitutional amendment as a second best option?
Absolutely. I would love the courts to rule in our favor on equality. We were just talking about the other states that have seen it happen. I'll take it.
All right. Representative Zamarripa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was State Representative Jocasta Zamarripa from Milwaukee. She, along with Senator Tim Carpenter, announced new legislation yesterday evening that would repeal Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage. It's Food Friday time, and since it's Valentine's Day, we thought we'd throw a little chocolate at you. Chef extraordinaire Ian Knauer is back with us today to give ideas for working with chocolate and what to eat if you're boycotting Valentine's Day. Ian, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Well, whether or not we're celebrating Valentine's today, you gotta love chocolate. So how important is it to have at least one decent chocolate dessert up your sleeve?
Well, I think any cook needs a really great decadent chocolate dessert that they can go to at any time. So whether you like it or not, someone that you like to cook for likes it, so you should definitely have one on hand.
Well, and you just used the word decadent, Ian, and I think, you know, decadent and molten chocolate cake goes together. Those gooey ones with the runny chocolate in the middle, it's hard to imagine anything more decadent than that. They seem hard to pull off, are they?
Well, actually, that's the trick to them. They're one of the most simple, one of the simplest desserts that you can make. And in fact, batter can be made ahead of time and kept in the refrigerator. A molten chocolate cake is one of those desserts that everybody orders when it's on a restaurant menu, and there's no reason why you can't make it at home.
You've shared a recipe for this with us, Ian, and we've got it on our Facebook page, and already a listener declared her love for us for sharing that recipe with her. Can you run us through what it takes to make this molten chocolate cake?
Sure. So the recipe that I sent you guys that you put up on your website actually makes enough batter for 8 individual cakes.
Or four servings for the two
right,
people.
Exactly.
Right, yeah, good.
Right. but like I said before, you can make this batter ahead and it keeps in your refrigerator. So anytime you want to make some, just scoop out enough for one or two or however many cakes you want to make, and then you can just bake them off. And the batter itself is really simple to make. So you start out with, and this sounds like a lot, but again, we're talking decadent here, 1/2 pound of unsalted butter and 1/2 pound of bittersweet chocolate. Now that chocolate, you want to be pretty dark. I prefer a 70% chocolate. You could use a 60% if you wanted to, or maybe even go up to a 72%, but I like to keep it at 70%. You can get that at most grocery stores now. What you do is you melt those together over a water bath. So you put the butter and the chocolate in a bowl and place that bowl over some simmering water, and slowly the butter and the chocolate melt together. Then you want to whisk in 1/2 cup of sugar and let it cool to warm, and then you want to beat 3 large eggs and then beat them into that chocolate mixture. And then you want to add 3 tablespoons of all-purpose flour and a pinch of salt. Now, that is just barely enough flour to make the cake hold together, which is what you want. If you add any more than that, then it feels cakey, which you're not going for. And if you add less than that, then it tends to break. So what you want to do then is you want to divide your batter between some buttered ramekins, and I use 1/2 cup per serving, and then bake them off in the oven at 350 degrees. And it takes 20 to 30 minutes, so check them at 20. What you're looking for is a nice amount of jiggle in the center there. You want to take them out then and let them cool and warm and then invert them on a plate, and they pop right out of those molds. Now, what you're essentially doing here is you're underbaking the cake. That's how you get the gooey center. So it's warm in the center, but you don't bake it all the way through, so it never actually solidifies.
So if you're used to making maybe brownies, for instance, you want to pull these molten chocolate cakes out before they would get to the point where you would think, say, a brownie would be ready.
Yeah, long before that. Exactly. That's right.
Ian, this sounds pretty simple and straightforward, even to me, but I'll admit my ignorance here. What is a ramekin that we're baking these things in?
A ramekin is a ceramic container. And you can get them at almost any kitchenware store. And they come in all different sizes. I'm sure that you've seen them. You've probably seen them if you order like a creme brulee at a restaurant. It often comes in a ramekin as well.
Oh, and those things can go. I've had that. They can be right in the oven then. They're not
exactly
just a
right. Yeah, you can bake in them.
Well, and since Rob might be a little on the more remedial end with things like ramekins, maybe we should give him a recipe for something that doesn't even need a container. So maybe, Ian, what about chocolate-covered strawberries? Those seem really romantic and even easier than a molten chocolate cake.
They are, yeah, and I agree. They are super romantic. Anytime you serve them to someone, you can expect a kiss in exchange. The secret to chocolate-covered strawberries is to add a little bit of fat to your chocolate. So if you prefer milk chocolate, you can use that. If you prefer a darker chocolate, you can use that. Melt it down. In fact, the microwave is a really good way to melt chocolate on your lowest setting in the microwave. and then whisk in 1 tablespoon of butter. And then let that cool just a little bit before you dip your strawberries in there. Then place your strawberries on a piece of wax paper and put them in the fridge. That way, the butter in there ensures that you don't get that brittle chocolate on the outside. It's a little softer. It's a little more luscious.
I've seen that. Maybe when people didn't put butter in it, where it's just it isn't quite right. It doesn't hold together right.
Exactly.
So the butter is the key.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So when you take if you don't put the butter in, you take a bite out of it, the chocolate shatters everywhere and it makes a mess, and it's not nearly as sexy.
Well, and I'm thinking along the lines of chocolate dipped strawberries, you could also do dipping lots of different fruits and maybe even cake in, say, a chocolate fondue.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, anytime you get to play with your food at the table, and fondue is a really easy way to do that, you're going to have much more fun and, you know, things always happen when there's chocolate fondue involved.
I like the way you think, Judith. Dipping cake in the chocolate
well,
goo.
Yeah. And so, Ian, maybe there are some people that are not all caught up in the Valentine's Day feeling warm fuzzies. You have some suggestions for a tasty but in some ways decidedly un-Valentine's Day meal. What have you got for us?
This is actually a menu that I've always wanted to cook on Valentine's Day because I'm one of those people who does not believe in forced romance. I think, if romance is happening, then that's wonderful, and it shouldn't have to happen on Valentine's Day. So if I were going to make an un-Valentine's meal, I think I'd probably start out with a crostini with roasted garlic and like a white bean puree on top. And, of course, the garlic will make your breath smell like garlic, and the beans will probably give you gas. So there's nothing sexy about either one of those things, but it is totally delicious. And then I'd move on to a pasta, maybe with the broccoli or broccoli rabe, again with the gas factor, and the pasta is going to make you heavy and sleepy. And then for the main, I'd probably do something like a braised ox heart. So, you know, you actually get to eat a real heart. And heart, I mean, some people might seem a little squeamish when you think about braised heart, but
yeah.
It's actually really delicious. It's beefy and wonderful. It's probably one of the best beef stews that you can make.
Really?
Absolutely. I might even serve that with like a quick pickled shallot vinaigrette. Then again, you have some raw onion in there, so you know you're just kicking your breath up a notch. And then for dessert, I'd probably eat a whole pint of ice cream, have a martini, and smoke a cigar.
Well, and I have to say, I think instead of that being unromantic, it's just a mature, more, more settled in kind of love.
Right, exactly. Yeah, this is the kind of love that you want to cultivate for a lifetime.
Or you could just hold on to this for a great breakup meal. something to end the relationship. On a tasty note, but you're creating that separation there with the garlic and the beans.
Right. Yeah, send them off with garlic breath.
And Ian, are there any beverages that you really like to go along with these romantic desserts especially?
Yeah, one of the things that I really like is a sweet red wine. And you can find some really good ones these days. It used to be that you only were able to find cheap Lambrusco, that not very good Italian bubbly wine. But there are actually really good versions of that available now throughout the country. So I would start with something like that. It's slightly sweet, but not too sweet, so it doesn't overpower the subtle sweetness of the chocolate.
And a nice glass of port would go along with those too, I'm guessing.
You bet. Yeah, that would be a perfect pairing.
Ian, while we've got a couple minutes, I know you're big on seasonal type stuff. It's been a bit chilly here in Wisconsin. I gather you've had a spot of weather in the Northeast as well. What's keeping you going as far as seasonal foods while you're waiting for the spring?
I've been feasting on a vegetarian Moroccan style stew. So there's no meat in it. There's no animal product whatsoever. But that's sort of beside the point. Which is that it's really, really satisfying. So I use butternut squash and carrots, and they stew away with some canned tomatoes. And here's the secret ingredient, some dried dates. I chop up about 8 dates and put them in there. And they add a really nice subtle sweetness and sort of like a malty caramel flavor to the stew. It doesn't make it sweet, but it balances it really perfectly. And then I use some warm spices like coriander and cumin and cinnamon and bay leaves. And it's one of those stews that makes a big pot. So if you have friends and family over, it's great for that, but it also makes incredible leftovers. So Any day for lunch, I'll go into the fridge and just grab some of that and heat it up, and it really hits the spot now. We're living in the polar vortex.
Well, and I have to say, since my husband and I spent our honeymoon in Morocco, for me, anything Moroccan is romantic and lovely.
So you can just have it for Valentine's
Exactly.
Day.
All right, Ian, just a little time left. What are you making tonight? You've outed yourself as a Valentine's Day denialist. So are you just going to make something basic? Are you going to make your anti-Valentine's Day meal, or what do you got going on?
I might do some of the anti-Valentine's Day meal. I might do the white bean crostini. That actually sounds really good to me. But I have some wild boar sausage that I've been waiting to cook up, and I'm really looking forward to that.
That sounds great to me.
Ian, I've got to know, when are you just going to move here to Wisconsin so that all these foods you talk about, you can just bring into the studio and we can share them? It's a good state. You should head over here.
That sounds really fun. I'll let you know when I'm in town.
Well, and Ian, I think one of the things about wonderful food and great eating experiences is actually the presentation. Is there anything special that you like to do to kind of dress the plate up a little for a special occasion like Valentine's Day?
So if we go back to that molten chocolate cake, there are a lot of different things that you can do to make it look really sort of chef-y, like it's actually coming out of a restaurant kitchen. You mentioned port earlier, and I like to make a sauce from port. So I'll boil some port with a little sugar and some orange zest until it becomes a syrup, and then drizzle that over the cake, put a dollop of whipped cream on top, and then here's a really neat chef's trick. Take some cocoa powder and put it through a fine sieve and just dust it right over there. So you get the chocolate from the cocoa powder, the chocolate from the cake, the sweetness of the port, the wininess of the port, and then, of course, the whipped cream.
Sounds beautiful, Ian. Thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Happy
Ian, Valentine's Day.
You too. That's Ian Knauer, farm-to-table chef. We've got his recipe for molten chocolate cake on the Central Time Facebook page.